Hello, my dear friends. We got a rookie on the boards today, so. Oh, welcome to the show, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. We're having a good time here. Oh, I see a beautiful sight, though. My board is all lit up with callers, and always warms the cockles of my heart to see that. And I'll be getting to your calls shortly. Greg Kokel, as I said, Stand to Reason. This is the show that turns your mind on, and when your mind's working, your brain's growing. And when your brain's growing, then that helps your mind, too, because they all interact, and that's a cool thing. By the way, I don't have the most recent figures for Minnesota. Does anybody have those yet for the rethink coming up in, what, 3 weeks now? Is it about three or less than 3 weeks? Less than three, about two and a half, three weeks, a little more than 3 weeks. 3 weeks from Friday. What is that? That's November 8th and 9th in Minneapolis. And, oh, my goodness, well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm actually going to be up there the whole week because I have an event in Minneapolis the weekend before that. And I figure, why fly out, fly back, fly out again? And so we're able to put some other things together, and I'll just be there for the week. Anyway, last count I had was over 1,600, and that was over 4 weeks from the event. And can you imagine what else, where else do you get 1,600 people? Young people especially who sign up for an event 4 weeks before the event itself. That's really a good sign. Anyway, most of you know about RethinkApologetics.com. That's the place to go to get the information about our event coming up in Minneapolis. We also have Birmingham in the spring and January, February, March, and I think in April we have Dallas, and so we've been doing that for a few years. Okay, just so you know, in Minneapolis, November 8th through 9th, our speakers there will include J. Warner Wallace, Christopher Yuan, Frank Turek, the great Frank Turek. You want a piece of me? Okay. And, of course, the Stand to Reason crew. And we'll be at Grace Church in Eden Prairie there in Minneapolis, the largest church in the state. We're thrilled. Really looking forward to that. You go to RethinkApologetics.com to sign up for that. Now, I learned something new this weekend from my pastor. And I don't get to go to church very often, as it turns out, because I'm often in somebody else's church, but this weekend I was home, I went to church, and there was a part of the teaching entailed a reference to a verse in Proverbs that is often misunderstood. This is the way he characterized it. I think he's right now when I look closer at it. It's Proverbs 29:18, and that's the passage that says, let's see, how do people usually put it? With, let's see, it's where there is no vision, the people perish. Where there is no vision, the people perish. And my New American Standard Version translates it differently, and in fact so differently it gives it an entirely different meaning to the passage. But I think this might come out of the King James, and so people get this in their head and they quote it a lot because they're using it to emphasize the need for vision. A vision for the future, or a vision for one's own life, or a plan of some sort, a deliberate or an intentional goal that we need to shoot for in order to be productive, especially for an organization of some sort, like a church or like a Christian ministry. And of course, we think at Stand to Reason in terms of vision a lot, because we not only have an activity that we do as an organization, that would be our mission. And our mission is very simply and straightforwardly to train Christians. We train Christians to, one, think more carefully, and two, defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. And we want them to do that in a winsome and an attractive way. And we're building ambassadors for Christ in order to accomplish that goal. But that's our activity. But our vision is different. Our vision is what we want to accomplish. And what we want to accomplish is confidence for every Christian. That, in my heart, that is the number one thing. I want other followers of Jesus to be confident they are on the right track with Him. confidence for every Christian. But then there's more, right? Then there's challenges from the outside, okay? So we want clear thinking for every challenge. Not just confidence for every Christian, but clear thinking for every challenge. And of course, if we have clear thinking on the challenges so that we have good answers to the challenges, that means it's going to build the confidence of the Christian. But there's more, because we want them to engage right in a winsome and attractive way. And so what we want to accomplish is that there is courage and grace in every encounter, or for every encounter. So our goal, mine, with you, and anyone that our organization is working with or mentoring or having an impact on, either near or far, is that you grow in your courage as a Christian, in your clear thinking regarding the challenges, and in your, I should say confidence. Did I say courage? Confidence as a Christian, your clear thinking regarding the challenges, and your courage and grace for every encounter. So vision is important for organizations to have a clear target to shoot for, a clear understanding of their activities. That's our mission. And then what is the target our activities are shooting for? That's our vision. But Proverbs 29:18 is not talking about that. That's the service that the verse is usually pressed into, but it is not what the passage is about. So even though people misuse the passage, I think it's like good sermon, wrong verse, all right? So what is it talking about? Here's a more precise translation. And in my New American Standard, it does say where there is no vision, but there's a footnote there, and then it says, or revelation. So where there is something that's missing, you might call it a vision or revelation, the people are unrestrained. The people are unrestrained. And then the next line gives us some insight. And by the way, you will notice in biblical writings, particularly the wisdom literature, there is you'll see it in other places too, though, but there's a thing called parallelism. And that's where you have a line, and then next to it, under it, following it, you have another line that is somewhat like it, but a little different enough to shed some light on the line before it. So you have two thoughts in parallel, and each kind of modifies the other a little bit, and between the two of them, you get a clearer picture of what's being said. And you have that here in verse 18, where there is no vision or revelation, the people are unrestrained, but, by contrast, happy is he who keeps the law. Oh, now we get it. What he's talking about with regards to vision or revelation that's missing is talking about the law of God, the revelation of God, the boundaries that God gives us to live within. Now, this is Proverbs. That means it's telling you smart stuff. The writer wants you to know how to live with wisdom. Now, I read Proverbs a lot, and I need to. In fact, I'm looking at the same chapter here, and here I've got one squared off with my pencil marking it so I see it. A fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. Notice, by the way, those are in parallel. One supports the other. Why do I have that marked? Because I have been known to lose my temper on occasion, and I want to be a wise man, not a fool, and so I want to learn how to hold it back. And by the way, learning to hold it back and being wise and doing what's right is kind of the point of that verse 18, because where there is no revelation, there is no guidance, there is no vision of that sort, there is nothing to create boundaries around the people. The people are not restrained. They are scattered. They're going hither, thither, and yon. And what's not being discussed here is having some vision for your life. That's the mistake. That's not what the writer of Proverbs is talking about. He is talking about the direct guidance or insight or wisdom or restraint, boundaries given by the law. The unrestrained people are not happy. The one who is happy is the one who keeps the law. Where there is no vision, the people are unrestrained. But where there is a vision, that is a revelation, that is the law, and we operate within that, then we're happy. Now, I think about this notion here by way of application, as I was thinking about this during the sermon, and sometimes your best thinking comes from something the sermon suggests for you, and you kind of pursue a line rather than what the sermon is all about. I mean, the sermon's fine, and there are good stuff. I always take notes. I have a notebook that I take to church, so I'm taking notes. But sometimes it's the reflection. The sermon kind of sparks the thought, and I think of, oh, well, that's good. I'm going to write that down. And the sermon's going this way. My thoughts are going the other way, but it's okay. Some people have said the best thing to write down when you're taking notes is what you're thinking about, that the talk or the speech or the sermon or the teaching has stimulated. And that's what I was doing. And I started thinking about where there is no law, no revelation, there are no boundaries that provide appropriate restraint. I started thinking about my family. I started thinking about how valuable it is for there to be order in our family. Now, anybody who's read stuff about child rearing and the like, and I'm not an expert in this at all, but I've read some stuff, and they say, you know, having boundaries make kids feel safe. And, of course, kids don't acknowledge that, not directly. Sometimes they're not really in touch with it because what they want to do what they want to do, right? But when we put boundaries there, we know a little bit about how life works, and we realize that inside the boundaries there's some safety, and outside of the boundaries there's danger. We want them to stay in the safe areas. And sometimes the boundaries, even if they're not restraining someone from something dangerous, that there are boundaries at all is itself something that has a salutary effect on our kids. I want my daughters, and I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that I am successful at this, but this is the point I want. I want my daughters to understand that to live life means living within boundaries. Even if their bedtimes are boundaries, are they arbitrary? Somewhat. 9:30, 10, 8:30, 11, whatever, you know, we can make them where we want. But if there is no bedtimes, then there is no restraint. And sometimes the restraint as restraint is good. I mean, I think it's good for there to be order in families, like order, for example, like schedule order. And what bedtimes do, if you keep them, it brings order to the household. And by the way, if your kid goes to bed at the same time every night and gets up at the same time every day, he or she is going to sleep better. And so will any adult who does the same thing. It's in every single thing that you ever read about sleeping well. The boundaries allow you to prosper in that way. And this is true in just about everything. Boundaries are really important. What is the world crying out for now, at least apparently? It's freedom from boundaries. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me how to live. Let me do what I want. It's a demand for autonomy. And there's a big, giant chunk of this culture that is happy to give that to a lot of people. That's real freedom, they think. But what we learn is that where there is no boundary, there is no revelation, there is no law, there's no vision, then the people are unrestrained and they're not happy. Why aren't they happy? Because they are not living consistent with reality. God gives us boundaries that a lot of times we don't like, but he understands what reality is like, and therefore, when we live according to them, we do better. We fare better. When we live in an unrestrained way, unrestrained by God's vision, by God's revelation, by God's law, we are not going to do well. But that's what people are demanding. Do you ever notice these folks that are demanding like that? They don't seem very happy. They seem like they're angry a lot. The ones that are oftentimes most satisfied are the ones that are living within the boundaries, within the boundaries of virtue, within the boundaries of God's requirements for life. That's what brings stability. I think boundaries in general bring stability, but some of those boundaries, as I pointed out, are arbitrary. But even the arbitrary ones, in that they bring stability, in that they create boundaries and order, that's a good thing. Sometimes that gets out of hand, of course, but I think you get my point. It's especially good for kids. But in addition to that, there are boundaries that are tied directly to the issues of virtue. And those things are good for our souls when we live out those virtues. Now, it's just like anything else. These are things that develop. Right now, my body hurts because I had been out of town for a bit, and I hadn't been in the gym for a while, and then I went a couple of times, and I overdid it a little bit. In fact, last 2 days ago, I was in the gym and did a chin-up. I can do chin-ups, but I haven't done them for a while, like 6 or 8 months, since I would kind of knock out 4 or 5 in a row. So I'm building up to it now. I did one full body chin after my workout. So I did my bench presses, my lat pull down, all of that stuff. But you know what? It hurt afterwards because I was like using muscles I hadn't used in quite a while. So that hurt. All of these things. You want to grow. You want to get strong in anything, physically or spiritually. It's not going to be easy at first. That's why disciplines are disciplines. But afterwards, says in Hebrews 12, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. And there it's talking about the discipline God gives to us, but it applies, I think, equally to discipline that we invoke, that we put on ourselves for something good. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. But afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So I'll just say in my own life, I'm trying to be more disciplined. At the gym when I can, but more importantly, for those things that have eternal consequences. I realize that without any revelation, that in my life there's going to be a lack of restraint, and restraint is good, particularly if the restraint is the restraint of a good thing, God's law, God's way in our lives. All right, lots of people to talk to here. Let's go to break, and then we'll go to your phone calls on Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. What's the problem with referring to the six biblical passages that address homosexuality as clobber passages? We'll find out my answer in the latest episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes or the top of the homepage at str.org.
All righty, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show. I'm just thinking, do I have any announcements? I'm actually going to Israel next week. Oh, I do have announcements. Okay. And I'm looking forward to that. I'll be with my wife and I and a number of colleagues. Thank you, Brooke. Here it is. And, okay, here it is, November 3rd, when I come back on November 3rd, that's the weekend before Rethink in, well, it says Buffalo, New York, but it isn't Buffalo, New York, it's Buffalo, Minnesota, okay, Buffalo Covenant Church, I'll be talking about Ambassadors for Christ, I'll be talking about tactics, I'll be talking about truth and faith, so I got a lot of things going on that Saturday, make that the Sunday, November 3rd, all day long, we'll be doing some stuff, Buffalo, Minnesota, in the greater Minneapolis area. If you're interested in participating in that on November 3rd, let's see, it's buffalocov.org. So BUFFALOCOV for information there. All righty, let's go to your calls. And who's on first? Tyler. Tyler, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
I had a question for you. So I had a conversation with a coworker today about evolution, and I was using the argument about the Cambrian explosion, how you see all the main body types show up and how we don't see the transition forms, or we don't have enough time to get those transition forms. And he said that I was arguing from a lack of evidence that we don't see those transition forms, but they could be there. We just haven't found them yet, and that that's a logical fallacy. Is that the case?
Yeah, I do not think it is the way that he has just kind of offered that thing. When we argue against evolution, the argument is a little bit more full bodied, and actually, you gave an example of it. It is not that there is no evidence for it. It is that there is evidence against it. That's a big part of our case. The evidence is against the idea that all of these significant tines, like the phyla that show up in an explosion, so to speak, at the Cambrian period, that there is, it's not just that there's no evidence of their slow development. It's the fact that there's no evidence for their slow development. And by the way, this is not controversial. It isn't like, yeah, you know what? We haven't really looked enough for this. We haven't looked in the right places. It's going to show up later, whatever. No, it's not there. What you have is a Cambrian explosion. So you have single-cell or multicellular things, little bitty things, pre-Cambrian. Then you have, you know, virtually all the phyla that ever existed showing up during the Cambrian period. What does that look like? That looks like a kind of creation event, not an evolutionary event. It's not a fallacy to say that you claim something took place, but there's no evidence for it. That's not a fallacy. What fallacy would that be? You're arguing based on the lack of evidence? Yeah, that's the point. That's like saying, you know what, that person said that I committed the murder, but they haven't produced any evidence for it. That's a fallacy.
Right.
You could be the killer. Well, who argues that way? You know what I'm saying? What if we said, is your friend an atheist, by the way? I'm curious.
No, he's actually a theistic evolutionist, so I was having difficulty trying to tease that apart for him.
Yeah, okay. Well, do you know that there's a book called Theistic Evolution that...
I own it, and it is very thick.
Yes,
so
it's very thick.
I'm slowly going through it.
Well, it eviscerates the theistic evolution. I mean, that's my opinion. In fact, I wrote an endorsement for that book, and that was one of the words I used. So it's very thick because there's a lot of good information showing that the Darwinian model, especially connected with some form of Christianity, is just a dead end. So anyway, so you've got it, so I don't have to recommend that. But there is a kind of challenge that atheists offer to theists, and they call it the flying spaghetti monster. Have you ever heard of this before?
I have, but remind me, please.
Well, what they do is they claim that our belief in God is like a belief in a flying spaghetti monster. There's also a similar thing called the invisible gardener. And basically, the point is that you are asking the atheist to believe in something for which there is no evidence. So there's a gardener that does all the stuff, but he never shows up. You never see him. You don't see any of his tools laying around. You see no evidence of his. So, but he still exists. The irony is, the charge that atheists make against Christians is that they think Christians are asking them to believe in something for which there is no evidence. Now, it would be silly for us to say to the atheist, oh, that's a fallacy. What's the fallacy? By the same token, if somebody there is denying Darwinian evolution because the evidence in favor of it is missing, how is that a fallacy? I guess somebody could say, well, it's possible the evidence is there and we haven't found it yet. But in a sense, that's even worse than the God of the gaps.
Right. Isn't that kind of science of the gap?
Yeah, it's even worse than that, because if evolution happened the way they said it happened, then we would expect to see a massive number of things like the transitions leading up to the Cambrian explosion and significant transitions I'm just going to call it functional transitions at all these stages of the development of biological life. But what you end up having is no functional transitions. You don't have a half wing and a half arm. And the reason that you don't have a half a wing and a half an arm is because that thing could neither, you know, fly or use the arms for anything. And it's going to get eaten by the first T-Rex that comes by, you know. It's not going to survive. But those are the kinds of transitions that we need to make the case of the evolution over time, little by little, from one kind to another. So I'm with you on this. I don't know what fallacy that would be. And for him to make this kind of claim, it's ironic, because if I as a Christian made that kind of complaint to an atheist, oh, the atheist saying there's no evidence for God, you're making a logical fallacy there, they would laugh at me. And with justification, if there is no evidence for God in all the places where we would expect to see it, well, then I think we're fair in believing there is no God, and we're not committing a logical fallacy. By the same token, if the Darwinian model predicts certain kinds of things in the fossil record, for example, and it turns out there are systematic gaps that are inconsistent with the prediction, then standard scientific approach then is to doubt the model. And that's what we're doing. The Cambrian explosion is a huge embarrassment to evolutionists, precisely because it's exactly the opposite of what you would expect would be the case if the Darwinian model were true. I don't see how that's a fallacy to raise that objection.
So you're saying that the lack of seeing transitional forms is actually evidence in itself for intelligent design?
It's exactly, because these things show up fully formed, and gaps between the fully formed individuals, okay? It's the kind of thing that appears abruptly on the scene. And in fact, I don't have my notes right in front of me, but I have a talk where I talk about this. And there are a number of people in the field that make this acknowledgement. In fact, think about this. One of the players who is now gone, Stephen Jay Gould, do you recognize that name?
I have, yes.
Yeah, he's a Harvard paleontologist, or was, and pretty high in the pecking order, and wrote a number of books regarding evolution. Well, he had a curious way of characterizing the evolutionary project. It was called punctuated equilibrium. And his point was that instead of evolution happening very slowly, he thinks evolution happened in spurts, that you had long periods of stasis, which is what the fossil record shows, and then you have such a fast change from one thing to another, you have this punctuation of the otherwise equilibrium state in the biological field there, that the fossil transition from the one to the other doesn't show up in the fossil record. And it was disparagingly characterized as evolution by jerks, partly because people didn't like Gould, and he could be, I guess, a little jerky. But you know what the objection to that was? Notice, by the way, that punctuated equilibrium is an evolutionary model that acknowledges the problem of the missing transitions. That's the first thing. Secondly, the reason that people objected to it, in part, it wasn't classic Darwinism, which is gradualism. They objected to it because it was empirically equivalent to creationism or intelligent design creation of some kind. That's one of the reasons they objected to it. He said, well, that looks like if what you say is what happened, people are going to see that and say, well, that's creation. See, nothing, no change, then bang, a big change, that's creation. Why? Because that's what the evidence seems to indicate. And so it isn't just that there's evidence against the Darwinian model classically characterized, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, okay? Let me back up. I misspoke there. It isn't that there is evidence missing that supports the neo-Darwinian paradigm, where you'd expect it to be there in spades. There is also direct evidence against it that seems to indicate the intrusion of an intelligent designer. And
right.
So it's you see, it's both sides of that coin that are in play here, and there is nothing in the slightest way that is considered that is a logical fallacy here. I don't understand that. It seems
okay.
Like he's just squirming under the point that you're making, and all he's got access to is crying foul. When theists do this, even the theistic evolutionists are quick to say, "Well, that's a god of the gaps." When in fact it's not, because there's no gap here. There's no explanatory gap, because we have an explanation of design to fill a gap where design seems to be implied by the evidence. So we have an explanation. There's no gap there. But what they have is no naturalistic explanation, and that's what the theistic evolutionist is going for, even though he's a theistic evolutionist. The theistic evolutionist, and you'll see this really clearly in the book you're reading, they think the Darwinian paradigm is actually sound. But they think God somehow used it, even though they don't say what God did. Because the minute you have God doing anything, well, that's intelligent design. They don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, he's a very smart guy, and our conversation was very pleasant. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't making a fallacy in any of my arguments. So thank you for clearing that up for me, Greg.
Yes, you're welcome. I do not think that you're making a fallacy in your point. And like I said, when Christians argued the way your friend is arguing, then it's the atheists who poke fun at them properly for requiring us to believe in something for which there is not good evidence. And in this case, it's contrary evidence, the case of the Darwinian model. To me, it's a weak way of clinging to his view. That's what I think. All righty?
Yep. Thank you very much, Greg.
All right, Tyler, I appreciate the call. Do we have a break going here, or what's happening? Let's just do this. Let's go to New York City. Okay, Joel, we got you. Hi.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Okay. Okay, what's on your mind?
So my question is, I had heard you say in some past conversations, probably past episodes, that you believe, like William Lane Craig, that God is temporal.
That God is what? Say it again.
Temporal.
Oh, temporal. Yeah, that
temporal,
God.
Sorry.
Yes, he's in time. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a way of putting it. But he, there are tensed facts true of God. That's true. That's correct.
Well, so I guess the question then, it got me thinking, is because people will talk about, you know, some of the problems that come up with an infinite or eternal universe,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is just the problems that come up with infinities,
right.
The idea being that we would never reach now.
You can't get an actual infinity by progressive addition is the idea. It's like you can't count to infinity is the general idea there, yeah.
Right, so I guess my thought was, wouldn't that apply to God if he was eternal and temporal?
Well, it depends how you would characterize it. What you're saying is that God is doing things for eternity.
Thinking thoughts. So he would never get to the thought of creating the universe, for example.
Right. I'll tell you how Bill Craig characterizes it, is what he says is that God is atemporal until creation, and then when time is created by God, then he participates in temporality. So that would avoid that problem.
I thought I had heard you say, and I thought maybe you had seemed to imply that he agreed, but maybe I was wrong about that. Maybe it's just your view, or maybe I misunderstood your view, was the idea that God... Well, even, you know, if he thought to create the universe, then that means there was a thought before and a thought after, or the thought...
Well, once he exercises his will to create the universe, that is the first moment of time. Prior to that, I'm not even sure it's entirely sound to say that God has thoughts if... we are thinking that his thoughts are discursive like ours. That is, that they're connected together. He has this thought, then this thought, then this thought, then this thought. That would be a temporal process, of course. I think there's a lot of theologians who would be uncomfortable with characterizing God's mental activity like that, because he's omniscient, so he knows everything, and it's kind of like if he, I don't know, I think this would be a problem with omniscience, but without going into that, all I have to do is say, like Bill Craig says, is that God was not doing any activity until he willed the universe into existence, which would be its first temporal act that he then participated temporally in afterwards. And so you wouldn't have an actual infinite in that situation. You wouldn't have that problem.
Right. So I think maybe I just misunderstood. I think in the past, like you had explained, like your reasoning for why you thought God was temporal, and it seemed like, and again, it sounds like maybe I misunderstood, that you were saying that his thoughts would progress in a temporal kind of sense. Therefore, and so that's what got me thinking about this. Like, if
okay.
his thoughts...
And to be honest with you, I don't know
what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I do. And I don't know what I've always said in the past. So, but part of my point about God's temporality at the moment is that God acts there are actions in history. And so if God acts in history, then his actions have a temporal relationship to each other, even for God. So if
God begins at creation.
Yeah. So once you have the creation moment, then you're going to get what you just were describing. And if it turns out that God is thinking, I mean, again, that I'm not sure about that issue, but because I'm not theologically deep enough to assess that question. But I mean, this whole thing about the impassibility of God and God's not changing, you know, there's no shifting shadow of God. And so if he's got his thoughts are, did I say discursive? I mean, cursive. I mean, they just kind of all connected together. Then that he goes from one thought to another thought to another thought. Some suggest that means that, you know, there's a change that's going on that's inconsistent with his immutability. But that issue aside, I think once God is temporal, once creation happens, then God participates temporally, you don't run into that problem that you're concerned about.
So you, I think, then maybe we're more arguing against what some Christians might believe, that God is not even temporal now.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I don't think God is outside of time, and the reason is it just seems inconsistent. There's no reason to say that. There's no theological reason to say that, for example. What Scripture requires is that God is eternal, that he had no beginning, he had no ending. It doesn't require that he's atemporal. There are other problems with atemporality. And particularly the problems it has for us. That means that there is no actual passage of time. The passage of time is an illusion. Time is just this big giant block, and like a book that God would read. Here's all everything. There's the book. When you have a story in a book, there are no time that passes. There are just relationships of before and after in the story, but there's no time there. You can go to the front. You can go to the back. In fact, that's the way C.S. Lewis characterizes God's relationship to time. But if that's the case, then there are no. God isn't doing anything except for being responsible for the story that sits before him from forever. If he acts to create, then after the act of creation is passed to God himself. And so it's not so much like having a temporal God puts God in a box. It actually opens him up to activity in our lives in a way that I think is consistent with what the Scripture teaches.
Yeah, and I've agreed with pretty much everything you said. That's why I was just wanting to get clarity on that. So basically your view then, if I'm not mistaken, is that God would be atemporal or was before creation, and then after creation he became or allowed himself to be temporal.
Well, by the nature of the fact, when God begins to act, then there are temporal; those are temporal behaviors. When God creates and then begins to act, the nature of his actions are temporal. Okay.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know how it gets a little weird when you start talking about some of these things, but I'm not sure about God's temporality prior to the creation. I haven't kind of decided that. Other people have offered arguments that God was temporal even before creation, and I just haven't been interested in getting in that. What I've offered
though, would you agree then that problem I brought up earlier would start to apply in that situation if that's the case, the idea of the infinite?
Well, it depends what's going on. If God is in a static state of loving in the Trinity and there are no events taking place, you won't run into that problem, even if there's kind of a duration of time that's passing. But it may be a problem, and that might be an argument against
it. I just feel like time, even though time isn't a physical event, time is still an event in the sense of a moment to moment, like, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And then I would also think that thoughts are also they would apply to that. Would you agree with that? Like,
well, definitely for us,
as well as thoughts.
For us, that would be true. I don't know about God, so I'm not taking a stand on what's going on before. So you may have a point, but Bill Craig escapes that problem because he believes that God is atemporal prior to creation. So it wouldn't be a difficulty on that view.
All right.
All righty.
Thank you so much, Greg.
You're welcome, buddy. Appreciate the call, Joel.
Day.
All right, bye-bye. All right, let's take a break real quickly, and we'll be back with more calls here on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind as I do every, well, that's actually not true, but on Tuesdays when I'm here. From 4 until 6, if you want to call, you can dial up 855-243-9975. That's my number. And you can also, then you talk to Amy Hall, of course, and she'll put you through. I have been out of town a bit this year, as it turns out. I'll be four continents in 3 months, as it turned out, long summer. But that's all right. I'm here now and taking your calls. And so let's go to Anchorage, Alaska. And I was in Anchorage a few months ago. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Did you know I was in Anchorage? When was I? In March or April or maybe early May, I think it was.
You know, I think I remember seeing something about it. We've been working through the busy season, but we're so sorry we missed you, though. We saw you in Dallas when you did Tactics.
Oh, okay.
At Watermark. Uh-huh. And my wife and I, so that was wonderful. So big fans of the show and what you guys are doing for, you know.
Well, good. Thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I just had a quick question, and please forgive the sound. I'm a dog walker, so I'm literally having to lock up a client's house, so please forgive me.
That's right.
You know, of course, since marijuana has been legalized up here, and of course, I believe medically in California there, and of course, Colorado, there's been some confusion in the church and just about, hey, it's legal and this and that, and I just wanted to hear your take on, you know, is marijuana, you know, smoking recreationally a sin? I just watched a great video on this last night, so I just literally got the notification that you were live and figured I'd
okay.
I just
well,
ask it.
Sure. Well, I'll give you my take on it. I'd be interested in what the video had to say. I don't know who, if it was secular or Christian or whatever, but Paul says in Ephesians, he says, "Do not be drunk on wine, for that is dissipation." Okay, or maybe another word for that is wasted. We've used that before in the past. Oh, man, I got wasted the other night. Okay, that's dissipation. So now we know what he's talking about. Now, when Paul says do not get drunk on wine, do you think he thinks it's okay to get drunk on, say, scotch?
No,
okay. So getting drunk on wine or scotch or beer or any of those things are all a mistake. They're wrong. Don't do it because they're dissipation. You're getting wasted, okay? You're putting yourself under the influence of something else that could be destructive. Now, he doesn't say don't drink wine, and it's clear that Jesus drank wine. He made wine. That was his first miracle. He just didn't make really strong grape juice, you know. And some will say, well, a new wine, they drank the new wine. That was like grape juice. They say, wait a minute. If you look to Acts chapter 2, the disciples who were then filled with the Spirit because of Pentecost were accused of being drunk on new wine. So I guess there was a little punch to new wine back then. No, Paul says, do not be drunk on wine, but be filled with the Spirit. So he gives an alternative. Don't be under the control of some foreign substance, but rather be under control of the Spirit. Now, the reason that I asked you about those other types of alcohol was to demonstrate that the thing that Paul was concerned with is not necessarily the source of the drunkenness, but the fact of the drunkenness. Okay?
Right.
So the question really we have is marijuana in the same category? And it seems to me it definitely is. Now, I'm 69. Okay, I graduated from high school in 1968, all right? So this is when the whole counterculture was happening and the marijuana and the LSD and the whole thing. So did I smoke dope before in the past? And the answer is yes. It was just part of the culture. It turns out for me, I didn't smoke dope that much and I didn't drop acid. I didn't do psychedelics. I wasn't interested in that, but I had no moral compunctions about it. I had no moral compunctions about getting drunk either. I didn't get drunk very much. In fact, twice in my whole life, and they both times they made me sick to my stomach, and I thought, yeah, this is stupid. I didn't get the deal. So
right.
I did enjoy alcohol because it's a nice drink and it does have a little bit of a kind of effect of kind of lifting your spirits a little bit. And I don't think that's a problem. In fact, the scriptures speak of that in a positive way to some degree. Being drunk, that's a different story. Now, 50 years ago, the marijuana that we smoked was not the same marijuana that is being smoked now. Now the stuff is much, much stronger. And not only is it much stronger, there is a lot of... And so what you are essentially taking a couple of tokes, or whatever they call it now. I still got the 60s language, you know. If I don't know, taking a couple of hits or tokes or whatever of a marijuana cigarette, reefer, is going to get you a whole lot higher than a couple of hits 50 years ago, which means that the purpose of taking marijuana now is to get loaded. It's to get wasted. And that's what it does. There's also a lot of very reliable research out now showing that marijuana use leads to psychosis, neurosis and psychosis. This is a new development, by the way. I don't think this was the case 50 years ago, but it is now. And it's so ironic to me that, you know, the crowd that is against cigarette smoking, which isn't going to, you know, it's not going to kill you. Or look, at you're not going to die because I smoke cigarettes. If that were the case, I don't. But that means, but you could be the victim of me smoking marijuana because it's a mind altering drug. Then that's the point. And so I think it's wrong for those reasons. It's self destructive. And it's also being wasted. And as I got a chuckle here because there are some girls that drove up. I was walking across the parking lot picking up my cleaning from the cleaners, and they wanted to know where they pulled up. They're like college girls, right? There were three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Rolled down the window. Well, do you, and one girl seemed to be rolling a joint in her lap. And then another girl said, do you know where I can get some pot? So, I don't know why they thought I would know that, you know, because I don't even have a tat, for goodness sake.
You know,
I look like, you know, I look, you know, I look like as straight as you can look, it seems to me.
Sure,
but anyway,
sure. Yeah, that's odd.
Anyway, so they asked me, and I said, no, you gals, you shouldn't be messing with that. Or I said something. Then they were totally disdainful of me, you know. Oh, yeah, like, oh, get out of here kind of attitude, because I was trying to encourage them not to go that direction. And so as they drove away, I got my parting salvo. And I said, they don't call it dope for nothing.
Oh, nice.
There we go. So okay. I offered my best wisdom in the moment. And anyway,
grace,
I don't.
Right?
But I think there's a point there. It's dopey to smoke dope. All right.
What do you mean by the psychosis? Do you mind
defining
that for me, Lisa?
Yeah. Well, no. Psychosis is mental illness, and I listened to an interview of a guy who wrote a book about this, and he was on Dennis Prager's show. He's a talk show host, and his wife is a neuroscientist, neurophysiologist, neuro something. She's a doctor in that field, and she was he's a writer, but she kept pressing him to write about this because she says the research in the journals is so thoroughgoing and so decisive, it is unthinkable that the press is so quiet about the problems of marijuana. So he wrote a book about it. I can't remember the title, but I listened to the interview and I was quite taken with the evidence that he offered, and it concerned me a lot. So this is just another angle to that. Hey, look, Paul, I got to go. I appreciate the call, and I'm glad to be able to make my point here about the problems with dope. So I hope that people aren't following the crowd on this one. That would be dopey. In any event, Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.